From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, in the spirit of the UN's Conference on Women, we feature the stories of women from Iran, Pakistan, and the United States. Sadarai Farman Farmoyan grew up in a harem in the 1920s and 30s and went on to introduce the profession of social work to Iran. She was nearly executed after the revolution. Bopsy Sidhwa is one of Pakistan's most popular novelists and a women's rights activist. Also, some alarming observations about America's teenage girls. Psychologist Mary Pfeiffer sees girls in junior high school. She's found eating disorders, pregnancies, and self-mutilation. She's the author of the bestseller Reviving Ophelia. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews To Wong Fu, starring Wesley Snipes, Patrick Swayze, and John Leguizamo in drag. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the spirit of the International Conference on Women in Beijing, we're featuring interviews from our archives with women from different cultures. First, Sadarai Farman Farmoyan talks about growing up in a harem. She grew up in a harem, the daughter of an Iranian prince. But shortly after she was born, the family's dynasty was overthrown, and Reza Pahlavi crowned himself Shah. Her father spent the rest of his life under house arrest. In order to get an education, Sadarai Farman Farmoyan went to college in the United States. She returned to Iran to start her country's first school of social work, devoting her life to helping the poor and sick. She fled the country during the Islamic fundamentalist revolution and has since lived in exile in the U.S. I spoke with her in 1992 after the publication of her memoir, Daughter of Persia. I asked her about growing up in a harem with several families which shared the same husband and father.
You know, when I was growing up, you know, we were all children and we loved each other. We didn't know for a long time. I didn't know the difference because, you know, when I was born, that was the time that my father was imprisoned. All his elder sons were imprisoned. So my mother, who was very young when she married my father, she was 12. And she was a young woman. She was scared or went through all this hardship, what they say, that she couldn't nurse me. She was sick. So I was nursed by my stepmother. And so I grew up not knowing who was really my mother. So, but the relationship between the wives, they were all these four, especially the three of them, were the same age. They were young and they were confined to their own andarun, that means that their own household. My father would not allow them to go outside and search for activities outside the household. So they became very good friends. They cooked together, they sewed together, they socialized together. They talked a great deal about my father, and my father was a sort of traditional man who believed that the children should be clean, the children should be educated. So they talked a lot when we were growing up together, and we really didn't know any difficulty in their relationship. I never felt. And as a matter of fact, when my father died, these wives kept on seeing each other, and they were the best friend. And one time, I remember that when my stepmother, who had nursed me, died, my father, own mother, grieved so much. She cried a lot, and she kept on telling us that she lost her best friend, and there's no reason for her to keep on going. You see, the love for each other was that much.
Did you want to marry when you were very young?
Well, there was a lot of glamour attached, and that was the only job, only activity that they saw for girls. You see, we were not allowed to participate in politics. I mean, the girls I'm talking, we were not allowed to go to the to schools like the boys did. You see, when I was growing up, all my brothers who were the same age as I was, they were all sent abroad for education when they got to be 8, 9 years old. And I stayed home because I was a woman. So, and the only destiny I had as far as they were concerned was that for me to get married and have children. And so they glamorized it in a way. And when you are stuck to a confined anderun, and all you have in the future is they talk about, oh, soon you will find somebody who will bring you jewelry, who will bring you this. You see, any young girl is sort of tantalized by that. But I was more interested in getting education. My father was an enlightened and very, I can say that he believed in education. He educated his daughters, not sending them abroad, but in the schools available. He brought us tutors inside our homes. And my elder sisters, they all had a governess, a French governess. You see, when I got to be of age, he sent me to a school outside our compound. So he believed in education. He taught us to search for education. And, you know, in the history of Iran, my father was the first man who started a school for girls in the city of Shiraz. At that time, there was no girls' school in the whole country. So he really thought of education as an activity that the girls could attend and learn, you see.
I think it's always a challenge for contemporary American women to understand what it was like to grow up in a harem, and mm-hmm. and also to understand the restrictions that were living with the restrictions that were placed on women then. I mean, the women were basically confined to the house. Were there women in the compound where you were growing up who resented it, who wanted freedoms they didn't have? Did you, when you were young, want freedoms that you were afraid you would never have?
Yes, it was. You see, my father had organized everything we needed in the compound. We had school there. We had a carpentry shop there. We had a blacksmithy shop there. We had whatever. It really was a city in itself. And so the people who lived in the compound, they didn't need to go outside. But I know that my mother was very, very mad at my father, and she never forgave my father, even at the time that after even the death of my father, she always complained that he did not let her go out of the compound when my mother's mother was sick and died. So she didn't go to the deathbed of her mother. So that was the type that women were restricted.
You keep using the word compound to describe where you grew up.
Yes.
It was also a harem. Do you not like to use the word harem? Do you think Americans have, like, the wrong image of what that word means?
Yes, they did. I don't want it to be associated with Hollywood. For us, it's when I say compound, because it was a very large area of land, walled in, and in it there were houses for every wife, and each house was quite large, and we all had our own garden, our own. Our house was a two-story with 6, 7 bedrooms and servants' quarters. You see, the same was with others. And then in the middle of the compound was my father's house. So therefore, it wasn't harem in a way that it's pictured in Hollywood. You see, it was real life. It was like people's home. The only way that was different was that we didn't have a father inside living with us. You see, and I never thought of it differently. I thought that the whole world was like that. The father always lived in his own quarter, you see. So when we were growing up, this was not a problem for me.
You came to the United States to be educated. This was for college, I think, was when you first came to the United States. What did going to the West mean to you and mean to your father, who was the one who supported your trip?
My father died when I was still in high school. So after the death of my father, I decided to pursue my education and I came to the United States. My father, I just want to tell you about my mother. My mother was very unhappy about my decision at first, but because war broke out, this is World War II, and it took me a couple of years to get a visa and to prepare my trip. Then during that period, my mother got used to the idea. So I came to the United States in search of better education. I wanted to do something for my people. I was concerned about the poverty, the illiteracy, the position of women, and all the social problems that I saw outside the compound. So I wanted to do something, and I thought that the best thing, since we were not allowed to go to university or to school in Iran, university was very new and only for men, so I decided that I'll come to United States. So I got acquainted with the American missionaries there, and they helped me.
What made you think that you, as a woman, could do important work?
Well, I saw no difference. You know, when I thought that I ran as fast as my little brothers. I climbed the trees as high as they did. I did all sorts of things. I memorized the poem our father gave on Fridays and learned whatever our lessons. I was doing very good at school, even better than boys, and I read whatever I was supposed to do. So I said, well, I am not behind them. So the girls could do whatever the boys can do. Why shouldn't I?
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Sadara Farman Farmoyan is the author of the memoir Daughter of Persia, we spoke in 1992. Coming up, a women's rights activist and novelist from Pakistan. This is Fresh Air. Bapsi Sidwa is a women's rights activist from a country where many women see the world from behind a veil. She's been a social worker in Pakistan and was her country's representative to the Asian Women's Congress in 1975. Sidwa is also one of Pakistan's most popular novelists and one of the first to be published internationally. I spoke with her in 1991 after her novel Cracking India was published in the States. It's set in the late 40s after England pulled out of India and the country was divided into predominantly Hindu India and predominantly Muslim Pakistan. Sidwa was 9 at the time of the partition, and she remembers the atmosphere of violence and betrayal as Muslims, Hindus, Parsis, and Sikhs fought among themselves. As a Parsi, she was part of a minority group. She told me it was a dangerous time for women.
One of the most terrible aspects of the partition was that hundreds of thousands of women were kidnapped, Hindu women and Sikh women by Muslims and Muslim women by Hindus and Sikhs. It's sort of very true of our part of the world that when you have to celebrate a victory, the victors do so on the body of a woman. And when you want to get rid of the feeling of humiliation at a defeat, there again you humiliate your enemy's women by raping them, etc. So the women were the major targets when it came to power play, humiliation, and celebration in this part of the world. So it was Hindu, Muslim, Sikh women, all of who suffered.
When you say they were kidnapped, where were they taken?
They were kidnapped by individuals, taken into their homes, raped, and then sold for 10 rupees each, 20 rupees each, which is less than a dollar, you know. People would be shouting in the streets, apparently, that zanana for sale, zana for sale. You know that women are being sold, and that's the price, 10 rupees for a woman.
When you became a woman, did you meet women who had been kidnapped and sold years before?
I may have met them, but, you know, this is something, it's considered so dishonorable and so defiling that women would not openly talk about it. Other women would whisper about it. And as a child, I would just catch innuendos and whispers about various women. Where I was living, right next door to me, was a camp for recovered women. These were the women who were kidnapped and then recovered after the partition from various places and brought to these camps. And we as children used to go onto our roof and peek into this camp and look at these very despondent, very poor sort of looking women who didn't talk much. I mean, now with my adult's imagination, I can understand what happened to them. But as a child, I couldn't grasp it. And the sad thing was that a lot of these women were not accepted back by their families because women are supposed to embody honor. You know, they're vessels for honor. And they had been dishonored, so the families didn't want them back into their households. And they were left to fend, you know, by a little training in embroidery and to eke out their lives like that.
You were married at the age of 19. You had three children. You've described yourself as having been an upper middle class housewife. Your husband was a businessman. How did you start becoming involved with women's rights?
This is very strange, actually. I read this book, The Female Eunuch, by Germaine Greer. This must be when I was about 25, 26. And I just got up the next day a totally different person, very aggressive, fighting with my husband, having temper tantrums all around, you know, till I decided I shouldn't read books like that. But that gave me an awareness of, well, why was I so submissive and why was I so accepting of taking the secondary place and being so subservient to other people, whether it was my father, mother, or husband. And then I got involved in social work, and gradually my interest in what was happening to women developed, and also my awareness of what was happening to women. I started doing a lot of social work with destitute women's homes, with orphanages, and there I came across instances which really sort of left their stain on me, and I wanted to do something about it.
When you say that you were tired of being subservient to your parents and to your husband, what was the typical middle-class marriage like in Pakistan or at the time? When you talk about subservience, what do you mean?
Well, you know, you are always waiting for your husband. You're more or less a public relations officer to your husband, entertaining for him all the time, taking phone calls. If you go out in a car, you're the one who's waiting endlessly for him to do his work and come in. And you take everything in your stride. You're told this evening so many people are coming, or this day so-and-so is coming, or keep the house ready, we're expecting so many visitors, or at the drop of the hat, let's travel. I mean, you totally sort of sublimate your life for your husband's existence, before that for your parents' existence. These are very little things, and they're not very demanding, but in the end they accumulate and make for a great demand on one's time.
When you started working with destitute women, did you start becoming aware of the class differences and how women were treated in your country?
Yes, the class difference is there enormously. Among the very poor, the women don't observe the veil, and they work in the fields with the men, except, of course, the village leader's wife. She would observe parda. And her work is not really accounted for in terms of cash. You know, it's free labor. And then when they enter the middle class, interestingly enough, at this point, the woman says, okay, now I'm better off, so I'll go in behind the veil. I'll wear a veil. So it is a status symbol that now my wife does not need to work. We are better off. Then as you get to the much richer classes, then it is the women they don't observe the veil, except if they're in very narrow-minded villages, if their husbands happen to be in the mountain villages, you know, sardars or lords out there. And these women have more or less the freedom of a wife in America, perhaps. So the class does make a great difference. And then when I was working in the destitute women's homes, that's when I became aware what had happened. And it's a strange thing that in Pakistan, men outnumber the women. And in these destitute women's, in the home I was working, there were a lot of women with children. By 19, a woman has produced perhaps 4 children. And if there were 25 women in the home, there would be about 300 men wanting to marry them. And once or twice I realized that perhaps there was something wrong going on, because I saw a dwarf and a very sort of cruel-looking man getting married to a very beautiful young woman of 19. And after that, my friends and I decided that we would interview each of the bridegrooms before something like that happened. And we would interview the bridegrooms to find out what they wanted to marry for. Most of them said, oh, you know, we have so many chickens, we have so many goats, we have so many sacks of wheat, and we have nobody to look after it because my wife died. And then we'd say, but you don't want a wife, you just want a free servant. And if a man showed some inclination to romance, that, look, I've had nobody to arrange my marriage because I've been busy for this reason or that reason, and I would like to get married and have a home of my own, then we would introduce the woman, or at least let them have a look at each other and arrange a marriage between them.
Do you see religion as an anti-feminist force in Pakistan?
Not the religion itself, but the way it is practiced and the way the mullahs and particularly the fundamentalists interpret it. Sometimes I feel they use religion as something with which to browbeat women and make them more subservient. God knows they're subservient enough, and still they're not satisfied. And they certainly use religion to do so. But a lot of Pakistani women feel they ought to interpret religion according to their lights, and the Quran according to their lights, and they feel they'd come up with a different interpretation.
What are the things about the status of women that you would still like to see changed in Pakistan?
Oh my God, a lot of things, most of the things. I would like them, first of all, to get education, to get more control of money, more control of their lives. I certainly would like to see any brother, husband, or father who kills his wife to be just hung. I mean, I'm absolutely for capital punishment when it comes to that. Because brothers and fathers think it is their right, you know, to, if they feel their sister is flirting or has had a secret affair, even with her fiancé, they feel quite justified in killing her. This is, of course, again, we are talking of a class, the peasant class, the poorer classes. And just every sort of zulm, now I'm trying to think, every sort of bullying tactic is used on women, and women are supposed to accept it. And I think I would like to see a lot changed.
Any impressions of the women's movement in the United States?
Yes, of course, I've experienced it, but it's a totally different breed of feminist movement here. Their priorities are different, and their way of handling issues are different. I think there's this huge cultural difference which makes us to react to different things in different ways.
What do you see as the main difference between how the American women's movement handles issues as compared to what you're used to?
It seems to me that they have probably resolved some issues and their priorities have shifted to things which, at this point, because our problems are so enormous, seem to us a little trivial. And we want to be fighting for things where women are in constant physical danger, physically being kidnapped from many parts of the countries to be used in prostitution, and the society turns a blind eye towards it. But I know there are some serious problems women face here, and they have to keep struggling against it too.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Bapsi Sidhwa, recorded in 1991 after the publication of her novel Cracking India, she divides her time between Pakistan and the U.S. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how America is destroying its girls. We talk with psychologist Mary Pfeiffer about eating disorders, self-mutilation, and underachievement. Pfeiffer is the author of the bestseller Reviving Ophelia, Saving the Selves of Adolescent Girls. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new comedy about drag queens to Wong Fu. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Adolescence is always hard for girls, but it's been getting harder. Psychologist Mary Pfeiffer has reached that conclusion through her work with junior high school age girls with eating disorders, girls who mutilate themselves, girls who are pregnant, and girls who have virtually stopped communicating with their parents. We're not talking about problems that are only found in big cities. Pfeiffer has a private practice in Lincoln, Nebraska. She shares some of her disturbing observations in her bestseller, Reviving Ophelia, Saving the Selves of Adolescent Girls. I spoke to her when it was first published last year. She told me what she sees happening to girls once they reach adolescence.
Well, I think girls go from being very whole, zesty, complete, curious, lively human beings at 8, 9, and 10 to being diminished, truncated versions of themselves by time they're 12 or 13. There's a couple markers at that time that are very important to girls. One is when they start puberty and their physical development into womanhood. And the other is when they start junior high. Usually between about 10 and 13, those things happen to girls. And when those things happen, they stop being as authentic and whole and become quieter, more passive, less curious, and so on.
You say with a lot of adolescent girls, their voices go underground, their speech becomes more tentative, mm-hmm. less mm-hmm. articulate. You see that happen a lot?
Absolutely. One teacher put it this way. She said, at 11 years old, girls that are ignored shout louder. At 13, if they're ignored, they're silenced.
So what else do you see besides this insecurity? You see a lot of eating disorders?
Well, I wrote the book because what's happened to me in the last few years is my office has just been filled with junior high girls in trouble. They have a variety of complaints. Some of them are depressed. In our community, 40% of all girls by the time they're age 15 have considered suicide. So I see a lot of girls that are depressed and suicidal. Lots of girls who are running away from home, who are refusing to go to school. Girls with eating disorders, and increasingly girls who are cutting and burning themselves as a way to cope with stress. What happened is, as I saw all these girls, many of whom come from very good homes, homes where there are two parents, no one's abusing chemicals or abusing the daughter, I really started to think, what's going on with girls that they're under this much stress?
A lot of adolescents start to be very embarrassed by their parents, and this is a kind of old tradition in America.
That's for sure. I can speak from experience on that.
Yeah, and the parent is supposed to walk like 10 paces behind the kid at the mm-hmm, shopping mall mm-hmm. so that nobody knows they're related.
Absolutely.
They can't talk in public on the train or whatever.
Absolutely.
Right? So is it often the parent who brings in the daughter for therapy to you?
I see a lot of mother-daughter pairs that are really fighting at this age, and the mothers are so troubled by it and absolutely baffled by it because they will have had wonderful, loving relationships with their daughters. This will seem to just come up almost overnight. And I think several things are going on there. I think one thing is, in this culture, we define adulthood as turning away from parents. And one of the things girls almost have to do to be accepted by peers and see themselves as moving away from home and into adulthood is reject their parents. So part of this is a culturally induced distancing from parents. The other thing I think that's going on is girls at this age see adulthood as engaging in many self-destructive behaviors, such as smoking, drinking, drug use, dressing seductively, sexual activity. Obviously, their mothers don't see these as good things for them. And so there's a lot of tension around rules, limits, what behavior is and isn't appropriate, with the mothers really trying to keep their daughters healthy and safe, and the daughters fighting hard for the right to be able to, in some cases, self-destruct.
What are some of the issues that come up around sexuality, whether to have sex or not, when you see people in your practice?
Well, girls at this point in time have a very difficult time dealing with sexuality. I mean, first of all, they have three very complicated issues to deal with. They have the issue of coming to terms with their own sexuality, which has always been a issue for women this age. They also have the problem of defining sexual relationships in a pluralistic society. And finally, they have the difficulty of not being sexual assaulted. You know, there's statistics now that suggest about 30% of all young women are sexually assaulted. So they have to figure out some way to be sexual and to be safe.
Do you see a lot of girls who are pregnant?
I see girls who are pregnant. I see girls with sexually transmitted diseases. I see many girls who are promiscuous. And by the way, these sexual issues don't get sorted out very quickly. I also teach at colleges in Lincoln, and oftentimes girls in college are really about as mixed up as junior high girls. One college student told me one time, she was talking about sex on campus, and she said, you know, a lot of us just don't know what to do, so on Saturday nights we get drunk and do it. I mean, there's a lot of confusion in our young people around sexuality right now.
Do you find that a lot of girls have no idea how to say no? I guess what I'm wondering is, if when you talk as openly as you can with girls about sex, do you find that they enjoy it at a very young age and that they really want to do it, or do you find that it's more kind of pressure and wanting to
be liked? I don't find that at all. In fact, I would say this, that the healthiest girls are the ones that tend to avoid sexual relationships until relatively late. The girls that are sexually active in junior high, almost all of them are eager to please, desperate to be liked, very desperate to be told they're beautiful and to prove to themselves that boys like them. The other thing is they tend to be fairly unconscious of what they're doing. I mean, I usually start out by saying to a girl that's sexually active, do you have any criteria for when you have sex? I mean, how do you make this decision? At which point, girls in junior high look very embarrassed and oftentimes will giggle or go, well, gee, I don't know. And basically what turns out to be the case a lot of times is they have sex if someone asks them to have sex. So one of the things I try to do with girls is say, let's you and I come up with a list of the things that need to happen before you would be sexually involved with a boy. And that's a major step when a girl starts having a few criteria and starts thinking before she has sex. Another thing, of course, many girls need is just assertiveness training. They need to practice with me. We'll role play and we'll have a lot of fun with this, my being a boy and proposing that they have sex and teaching the girl how to say no and how to counter some of the various ploys that a boy might use to encourage the girl to have sex.
My guest is psychologist Mary Pfeiffer. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with psychologist Mary Pfeiffer, author of the bestseller Reviving Ophelia, Saving the Selves of Adolescent Girls. You've been seeing a lot of self-mutilation in the last few years. What are you seeing?
Well, first of all, I had never seen a girl who cut or burned herself until about the last 5 years. And now what I see is basically girls who have been pretty healthy, but their parents often are bringing them in, Occasionally they come in through an emergency room because they're using razor blades or knives to cut themselves, usually on their arms, breasts, and stomachs, or they're burning themselves with cigarettes or candles. And when I talk to these girls, generally they all say the same thing, which is they get extraordinarily stressed. They don't know what to do. They feel totally overwhelmed. And so the way they deal with that overwhelmness is hurt themselves physically. And they almost always use the same line, which is, I would rather hurt on the outside than on the inside.
It's fascinating to me that it's getting expressed through self-mutilation, though.
Yeah. Well, it's really
very disturbing.
It's very interesting, isn't it? How, you know, I think about 10 years ago is when eating disorders really happened in my part of the world, at least. And all of a sudden, women were calling and saying, I don't even understand what's going on, but I'm vomiting all the time. I don't think self-mutilation is going to be as epidemic as eating disorders. I do believe it's a statement about the learning curve just being too steep for girls in adolescence right now.
There's a history in our culture of daughters being afraid that they're going to become like their mothers.
Yes.
You see a lot of that. What are the specific fears now?
Well, I think it's always been an insult to women to say, you'll just be like your mother. And I think that's a very sad thing in Western culture. I also think that in the past, women haven't had a great deal of power. And so girls haven't wanted to identify with a population group that was most clearly not in power.
Okay, but now we're seeing a lot of daughters of women who have power. They're professionals. They're mothers and professionals.
Yeah.
So when a daughter of a mother who has power now and who has kind of achieved professionally and has a personal life as well, when that daughter is afraid of becoming like her mother, what is she afraid of becoming?
What's happening, I think, when that occurs, and that occurs all the time, is girls have mothers who are strong and assertive, who are encouraging them to be that way. But then those girls end up in the very mean halls of junior high, and they're assertive, and they get called bitches, or they talk loud, and boys put them down, or they feel good about their violin playing, and then instead of people commenting on their violin playing, people comment on their chest size. And all of those experiences confuse girls. And first of all, they realize that the things that their mothers have told them are important aren't particularly important to their peers. And I think in some ways they may even feel a sense of betrayal of, why didn't you, my parents, warn me that this was what junior high would be like? The other thing they feel, of course, and they're right about this, is that their parents do not understand the world that they're living in. And I think that makes girls angry at their mothers. Girls actually, I think, have deep loving feelings toward their mothers all through this period. And they have a belief that sometimes gets them in trouble. For example, I think girls think oftentimes that their mothers have the power to protect them. And so when they're hurt, and even by hurt I mean sexually assaulted, oftentimes they're angry at their mothers. They have this sense that their mothers should have done something to make this not happen. And I think that comes from a very deep-seated cultural belief that women are somehow responsible for the well-being of everyone in their family. And if family members aren't happy, somehow it's the mother's fault.
So what advice do you give feminist mothers?
Well, I think one thing that's very important to keep in mind is girls' needs at this time. The world's changed a great deal, but girls' needs haven't changed very much. They need physical safety, and I encourage all girls to take self-defense. They need psychological safety, which means a home where they can be valued for who they truly are. Girls need help with stress management. They need quiet places and quiet times. They need challenges. They need meaningful work. And they need a sense of purpose. And I think parents can help with some of those things. What parents really can't help with, I think, in junior high is their daughter's self-esteem. Because self-esteem in junior high tends to come from peer evaluations. And mothers really can't do much about that.
You write that it's your goal when you're working with a young girl to teach her that the most important question isn't what other people think of her, but who is she?
Right, absolutely.
Now, how do you help a girl find that out?
Well, I recommend a variety of things to girls. One is that they find a quiet place and spend a little time every day centering. And that is looking within themselves and listening to their own heart when it comes to making decisions about what they want to do that day and so on. I also recommend that girls journal because that's a place where their thoughts really matter. I recommend that they think about questions like, what would I want on my grave if I were to die right now? Who am I really? What are my values? What do I value in other people? Girls, by the way, are very interested in these questions. They aren't questions they get asked very often, and they like to think about these questions, and they enjoy these conversations.
I want to thank you very much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this, Terry.
Mary Pfeiffer is the author of the bestseller, Reviving Ophelia. Our interview was recorded last year. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing all about the agreement in Geneva today on Bosnia. We'll be hearing from Sylvia Poggioli and from Tom Gelton and from people in Bosnia to find out what it means.
Well, Robert, you know, there's a lot of schedule changes happening on National Public Radio, and this is going to be the last time that Fresh Air and All Things Considered check in like this to find out what's coming up for
that's
you.
That's right. We have to stop meeting this way after today, and I'm going to miss our daily chats about what's coming up on All Things Considered.
Well, I will, too, and I want to say it's been a pleasure, and thank you very much. And I'll keep listening, even though you won't be telling me what's coming up on the show.
Okay, and I'll keep listening to you. Bye-bye.
Okay, and stay tuned for All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio. Director Bibon Kidron worked for years in her native London, making documentaries and TV movies, until her art house film Antonia and Jane brought her to Hollywood's attention. Her next movie was Used People in 1992. And now she's directed a Steven Spielberg production about three drag queens. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of To Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar.
Three drag queens hit the country roads, shocking every rube and hick in their path. Sound familiar? To moviegoers who saw last year's Australian film, The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, it should. In fact, a lot of people have denounced Wong Fu in advance as a shameless studio ripoff. Still, the Wong Fu script was circulating in Hollywood some 3 or 4 years ago. So, could the appearance of two traveling drag queen movies be a coincidence? Certainly the studios know there's an active gay movie-going public out there. And every so often, a gay-themed movie becomes a crossover hit, like Philadelphia, or La Cage aux Folles, or The Crying Game. The word on the Wong Fu script, by Douglas Carter Bean, was that it was funny, and that the thing to do would be to cast famously macho actors as queens of camp. So here they are, Wesley Snipes, with his biceps bulging and his false eyelashes flying, as Noxzema; Patrick Swayze, towering over the townfolk as Vida Boheme; and a wild card, John Leguizamo, as Chichi Rodriguez, a Latin spitfire in the Rosie Perez mold. Together, they're on their way to Los Angeles to participate in the Drag Queen of the Year contest. First, of course, they need a car, and their eyes settle on a used Cadillac.
Now, this is is a car.
A car? Mary, Alice, Louise, no, this is a land yacht.
You know, I used to know a lawyer guy who had a car just like this, and I said right then and there I was going to have it for myself. Ivita, can we have this?
Oh, but we did. I feel like Miss Jane Mansfield in this car. Ooh, Jane Mansfield, not a good auto reference.
That was Wesley Snipes dropping Jane Mansfield's name, and for a while the movie gets by on the other names it drops, from Sally Struthers to Menudo. But it isn't long before this movie's true intentions become clear. The so-called land yacht soon breaks down in an extremely unlikely hick town called Snydersville. Everybody there is downcast and bedraggled, and it requires three zesty, big-hearted drag queens to show the town folk the joy of living, to solve all their problems and leave them dancing and happy during the course of one wonderful weekend. In other words, Wong Fu turns out to be a syrupy, utterly pedestrian slice of warmed-over Americana. It's Shane in cha-cha pumps. It's the Music Man in a wig. It's Uncle Mame. The movie's presiding deity isn't Julie Newmar, it's Steven Spielberg, the film's producer. At a time when extraterrestrials had become fixed in the public mind as threatening creatures who wanted to destroy the planet, he came up with the benign aliens of Close Encounters and E.T. And so here. At a time when the political right repeatedly denounces gay culture as a menace to American children, Spielberg presents a Frank Capra-style fantasy in which a trio of airy fairy godmothers descend on the heartland, wave their magic wands, and fly back to Never Never Land, leaving not a whiff of sex or scandal or real life. Is it politically useful for gays to be depicted as silly but benevolent drag queens with no sex lives, no problems, no AIDS? Possibly. But does that make Wong Fu a watchable movie? It doesn't even feel like a movie at all. In fact, should you choose to cough up the price of a ticket, be forewarned. If this film turns into a hit, I hereby guarantee, exactly 1 year from now, a new phenomenon, Wong Fu the sitcom, coming to a television near you.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our archive edition was produced with Nancy Updike. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.